higher performance and faster and more reliable.
Good evening and welcome to Open Paddock, episode number 233 for Tuesday, May 27th, 2014. Tonight on the show, we talk about this, the greatest weekend in motorsport, where Ryan Hunter-Reay dominated the Indy 500. Gabby Chavez intimidated the Freedom 100. Jimmy Johnson humiliated the Flavored Corn Syrup 600. And Nico Rosberg urinated on the Monaco GP and got a little on Lewis as well. This is Open Paddock. Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining us this evening on this Memorial Day weekend edition of Open Paddock. And before we start the show, I want to say a quick thank you to all the veterans, all the active duty, and most importantly, to those who have paid the ultimate price for our freedom. And we also thank their families for the service of their family members.
I raise a glass to you all.
Indeed.
Amen, brother.
But to jump right into the show, let's do our roll call for the evening. I'm Mike Weitzel. I'm your humble host for this evening. And I am drinking a West Coast IPA that's brewed right here in Ohio. Misnomer of terms, of course, but it's from the Brew Kettle here in Ohio. And it's a lovely White Raja IPA, and I am just loving it. Also, joining us on the show this evening is Doug Patterson, kind of. He is suffering from the internet blues and will join us by phone in the Mazda Road to Indy segment when we talk about the Freedom 100 and all the other doings in that portion of the show. And thus, Mike Shaw has received a field promotion this evening to being second in command on tonight's podcast.
No longer the rookie, the intern, huh?
Do not fail me. Mike, what's your
job? Does that mean I get all your crap work?
Nice. Do not fail me, Mike. So what are you drinking this evening?
I'm actually having what you could call the peach and special. the limonada with vodka.
Nice.
With the that Portland potato vodka. It's a really good vodka.
Oh, nice. The peach and special. Vodka with something.
That's true, right? It's vodka with what's in the fridge.
And also joining us tonight on the show is John Olszakowski. He joins us again after completing more miles today than Kurt Busch did on Sunday. John, how are you doing? And I hope you're drinking something.
I most definitely am. I'm more tired than anything else. So I'm having a Samuel Adams Cold Snap, which was left on the shelf at the local gas station. So I snapped it up. It's going to be my sleep aid.
Nice.
It's an out-of-seasonal brew. You can't ask for more.
Hopefully it's not indicative of something that's going to happen later this week as we go from 90 degree temperatures here in the Midwest to something worse. Gentlemen, did you all enjoy your weekend festivities?
I didn't enjoy it ending.
Yeah, that's true.
I enjoyed it quite a bit. Got to watch some rallycross stuff on Saturday, and then Sunday I drove down to about 75 miles south of here, where my family lives, and got to spend watching the Indy 500 with my dad, and I haven't seen him for the last month, and he's been kind of going back and forth between being ill with a weird lung thing that he's got, and thankfully he's doing much better now, and it was good to just visit with him and, you know, spend some family time.
Good deal. Well, the show format for this evening is slightly different. We're going to start out talking about the Indy 500, then jump to the Freedom 100 and other MRTI goodness. Monaco GP will follow. We will briefly talk about the Flavored Corn Syrup 600, and then we will talk about Rally. And, Mike, it's going to be brief tonight.
Yeah.
So we will jump right as time is of the essence, and we will discuss the Indy 500 and how creepy was that gimp in the bathtub of milk intro. What were they thinking?
That creeped out Dale Jr., and he's a pretty laid-back guy.
I saw that. He tweeted out something about some girl was walking in the room. I don't even know who that was. Who was that he was talking about?
I have no idea. Yeah.
He said he was uncomfortable. Some woman walked into the room while he was watching the intro to the Indy 500, and there was a dude in a gimp suit in a bath of milk on the television. What are you watching?
What's hilarious is somebody directed me to that tweet, and I added it to my my sort of live blog that I was doing on Sunday. And later on that afternoon, I'm rewatching the intro video, and my wife walks up behind me and is like, "What's with the gimp in the milk bathtub?"
I'm so glad I missed that part.
It was just creepy because they had Joseph Newgarden with like milk running through his veins that they had computer generated upon him and all this weirdness. I mean, it was just, you know, they had some neat clips from the racing and everything, but ugh. I was far more interested when they did kind of a throwback deal where they're taking today's drivers and kind of editing them into
that was neat.
Classic footage.
That's what I was gonna say. That, you know, when they had the, was it McKay?
Yeah,
was it Bob McKay, Steve McKay?
And they
dubbed in, you know, they had the old, he's holding the mic, right? You know, interviewing, and they dubbed in what, like Castroneves and Juan Pablo Montoya and stuff like that to do the interviews. And
I thought
it was really neat.
I didn't know Chris Economaki ever looked like that. Because they had him kind of interviewing Tony Kanaan. It was pretty cool how they did that. And then they dubbed in some of today's cars on older footage and made it all grainy and everything. Yeah, that was really sweet. That was a good one.
Yeah, that was because this was the 50th anniversary of ABC. Yeah, covering the Indy 500, which was awesome.
Whereas the creepy gimp bathtub milk thing was a dairy commercial, I guess.
That must have been during the preview before the event, preview hour. And you know what? I happened to be still driving at that moment, and I was just listening to the radio coverage. So
it aired as part of the pre-race show that they had, and it was something for the regional dairy board or Midwestern dairy board or whoever provides the milk for the winner in Victory Lane. And everybody that I have talked to who has seen this just doesn't get it. It's like, what are they trying to promote? What are they trying to sell? Because it's not clear from the promo piece. It's just a bunch of weird, surreal imagery.
I would say I'm less likely to drink a glass of milk after watching that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, realistically, from just the piece, are they promoting milk or dairy products in general or the dairy board or IndyCar or what? It made no sense.
Suits.
Latex.
All right. Yeah, you know, the opening of the 500 this year was very classy. They had Jim Nabors get up there and do his traditional thing. And since it was his last year, you know, they put up a big old thank you, Jim, that they did in the stand with cards and all that kind of stuff that people were holding up. And that was cool. And then they had Mary Holman come up with Jim Nabors and give the command. It was a little stuttered on the broadcast, but
yeah,
it was a neat touch. I mean,
I don't think that was known ahead of time. I don't think Jim was ready, or you know, they had scripted what they were going to say.
Yeah. Well, whatever the case, that's classy, and it just shows how much of a friend of the family Jim Nabors has been over the years. Mm-hmm. You know, wow. You know, classy opening to the 500. Always brings a tear to my eye, and especially this is Jim's last year. And he looked like an old man this year. I mean, I've seen him many, many years up there, and there are times when he has a lot of vitality, and I hate to say it, but it won't be long before he's gone from this world, and it's a sad thing.
Yeah.
Very sad thing.
Agreed.
So, moving on to the race. Wow. We had a 151 lap stretch at the start of the race that was green, green, green.
Boy, this race is going to be over so quick. Oh my gosh. I've never seen it like that.
I kept telling people once the first yellow comes out, it'll just be a landslide after that. But first, I was shocked. It really went 151 laps, and it just seemed to go like that. It really did.
Yeah, except it went very quickly.
Except my back was crying.
We were trying to figure out, like, when the last time, you know, what the longest start of a race without a caution was, and they didn't have records. Like, it blew away any records for the longest green flag run at the start of a race. That was impressive, though.
Yeah, I believe the statistic I saw come up was that on average, I think it's there's within the first, well, first of all, when they first started the race, they said 14 of the last 16 races or something like that had a yellow flag in the first 15 laps.
Something like that, yeah.
And so, you know, that was something that, you know, you're anticipating something happening there. And then I think that was somewhere around like 141 or whatever they said that, you know, if this goes green all the way, that hasn't happened since 1976.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Yeah. That was also a rain-shortened race, I believe.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, I did not know that.
I wonder if they've ever went, you know, completely caution-free for the entire event. It was interesting to see some of the pit strategies early on. I think everybody was watching for fuel mileage because, you know, last year Honda definitely had the edge on fuel mileage, and they're thinking that Honda had the edge this year as well. The first stretch of pit stops started around lap 25 when Sage Karam came in early, and you know what? I think I know why that was. It wasn't because he was out of gas. I think it was simply because they wanted him to pit clean because he'd never done it before.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Except and they figured out, you know, if he mapped it out, if it went green all the way, that, you know, he'd still be in with everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, it wouldn't hurt him any.
Well, pit stop competition and practice, of course, he's done pit stops before, but never on a live track like that. So pretty good idea for them to bring him in early. But, you know, as far as things go with fuel mileage, you know, the Chevys and the Hondas all came in, and some of the Chevys were lapping on pitting on lap 29, 28,
I think 30. Majority, I'd say 90% of everybody was right around between 29 and, like, lap 33.
Yeah, yeah.
There were a couple of notable exceptions in Montoya, and I believe it was Dixon. They were able to stay out, like, two or three laps longer than anybody else.
They were, like, lap 36.
Inside run.
Yeah.
That was crazy.
Yeah, I remember Kanaan came in 31, something like that. So you know what? We were seeing that there wasn't a definite advantage on fuel mileage, at least for the majority of the cars. That there was nobody that was head and shoulders above everybody. If Montoya was able to take it to like 32, 33, that's a shot across the bow because we weren't expecting Chevy to be very strong on fuel mileage compared to the Hondas, and they certainly were.
Definitely.
Now, that green stretch couldn't last forever, and you know I hate to do this because this sounds so rude, but I'm thankful to Charlie Kimball for putting it in the wall so I could get up and stretch because my back hurt really bad from sitting on the aluminum for 151 laps. Oh my goodness!
At that point, I really, really had to pee.
Mandatory yellow flags for everybody to take a bathroom break.
Yeah.
Sounds like something NASCAR would do. Anyway,
but Charlie Kimball just looped it.
But not at first. He had the same thing happen about three or four laps earlier, and he saved it, and it is one of the most brilliant saves. If you watch his hand movements, oh my gosh. I don't know how he saved it the first time. But he obviously had some issues with the car just not controlling like he wanted it, and it just got out from under him and just spun around, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So that brought out yellows, and of course everybody dove to the pits. And at 151 laps to go, some fuel strategies were playing out, and you're thinking, oh, this is pretty good Ed Carpenter had just pitted right before that, and that meant he was good, and he was at the front of the pack. And as long as it didn't go full rich the rest of the way, which since they had the yellow at 151, that pretty much meant he could make it to the end of the race with one more stop. Other people were kind of in the same boat. But they had to pit on that yellow. We went green again, and I think one of the scariest accidents of the race was when Dixon broke loose in turn four.
Oh, man. That was a hard, hard hit.
Yeah, it was a hard hit. It came across the track. The car was just complete debris scattered everywhere. And that wasn't the only carnage in the incident. Newgarden woed up.
They're slowing down, yeah.
Yeah, Newgarden woed up, you know, yellow, yellow, yellow was called out over the radio, the lights were on, and they really didn't get much footage of exactly what happened, and they didn't even see it until later, but Martin Plowman came up behind him and took him out, and that completed his me duo effecta of wrecking people at Indy.
Yeah, it wasn't fun.
I don't think he had the best showing there with.
Yeah, he said he was fighting understeer, really bad understeer the entire event.
Did
Although
he?
Near the end, not to skip forward, but it looked like his car was definitely at least keeping up, not quite with the leaders, but you know was able to be closer to race pace. But yeah, the other challenge that was frustrating me watching Plowy was him not getting effectively out of the way when he should have, when his car was handling so bad.
Yeah, Plowman and Pippa Mann also was in the
yes.
way every time I saw her on the track. It's unfortunate to see that kind of stuff, but they really need to do some flag work on those guys to park them, unfortunately,
yeah.
Because Pippa Mann was more Pippa Chicane this weekend, and it was hard to watch. Plowman, you know, his race this weekend was with Graham Rahal. That's basically the only person I saw him racing on track, and Graham had a terrible outing and ended up, you know, parked pretty early on due to electrical issues.
I was going to say, if we did our first out voting, and you know we all would have picked him and would have had it right.
Yeah, indeed. So this brings us to about lap 176. We're going green after the 168 wreck, and we have an Ed Carpenter sandwich in turn one.
Ooh.
Ed and Bell, Ed and Hinch end up piled up against the wall out of the race. It was a three wide throwdown. Gentlemen, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, my first thought was when I saw the replay of it and whatnot is you see Townsend Bell does tap into Ed Carpenter, mm-hmm. who then hits Hinchcliffe, and then those two go into the wall. How Bell holds on to his car after that is kind of impressive. But, you know, obviously three wide into turn one never, ever, 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 ever works at Indy.
Two wide is almost impossible. Three wide doesn't work.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I was at first, you know, kind of slamming Bell on it. But as I saw looking at the lines, to me, what I saw was the racing line for the high line kind of diving down in. Mm-hmm. And the line that Ed Carpenter was on, which was a little bit lower. And then seeing how low that James Hinchcliffe was, sticking his nose down in there, I honestly agreed with what Ed Carpenter said. Hinch shouldn't have been there. He was too low for that corner. You know, others may disagree with that point, but... you know, it just didn't seem like it seemed like he was the last one there and sticking his nose where I don't think he would have made the turn without backing off.
Yeah,
because he was too low, and to make that sharp of a turn, he would have had to back off anyway.
Well,
the way he would have
made that turn is he would have used the additional grip from one of the people that was higher up in the corner, either Townsend Bell or Ed Carpenter, which is what ended up happening essentially. I got to agree with you. He shouldn't put his nose in there. It was three wide going in wasn't going to work. And, you know, Hinch just diving in there, I think it just made matters worse, more uncontrollable than it already was.
Yeah. I mean, Hinch made the claim that he thought Bell should have backed out, even though Bell was the furthest along in the corner. I mean, Bell entered the corner first. He was high. He was trying to make a pass on Ed Carpenter. Didn't quite get it done before they entered the corner, but he was still ahead going into the corner, which basically meant he had to come down the track or completely put on the brakes. Neither are going to happen. The only way Bell keeps from wrecking is coming down the track, doing a traditional line through the corner. With Ed Carpenter there, he can't have the entire track, but he has to come down. There's no way around it. The fact that Hinchcliffe was coming up from behind. Now, granted, I watched this develop, and it was a little less clear-cut than I thought sitting in the stands. You know, sitting in the stands, it's pretty easy to say, well, Newgarden dive-bombed, and he tried to take the corner down low, and he never would have made the corner and all of that.
You mean Hinchcliffe?
Yeah, thank you. beer one and a half.
Nice.
But anyway,
as I watched the replay of it at home earlier this evening, I softened a little bit on Hinch, but I'm still holding Hinch mainly accountable for that because he was alongside going into the corner. He didn't dive bomb into the corner at the last minute. He didn't come in way hotter compared to anybody else, at least in my opinion. It's just he was there a lot longer than I thought he was from the replays that I could make out at the track. So it's pretty easy to do it this way. If you want to assign blame on that one, Ed Carpenter is mostly innocent.
Mm-hmm. No matter what, he'd be the innocent party stuck in the middle.
Because he was the guy that was getting passed by everybody.
Yep.
And he was, really it was his corner because he had the line in the middle of the track.
He did.
Townsend Bell was trying to pass on the outside. He was partially innocent.
Right. I mean, he still
not
made contact.
Not mostly innocent, partially innocent. And Hinch was mostly to blame. There you go.
Yeah, and you know, and the bottom line is, and I think we all can agree, you know, you got how many laps are left to that? 28?
Yeah.
28 laps left of the Indianapolis 500. You're going to go balls out. You're going to hope the other guy flinches.
You want to finish the race, too.
You do, but how many restarts are there going to be? You don't know where you get that advantage, right?
That's true.
And it's not, you know, they're not using the giant wicker bills anymore where, you know, you could pass all day long, right? Yeah. The temperature was warmer as well. That factored into it. It wasn't going to happen unless you did it now.
Yeah.
And I think that was in their heads, and everybody just kind of went for it. And the coolest head of all of them was Ed Carpenter. And I loved his quote at the end because he still kept his head after they talked to him. And Carpenter was saying there, yeah, well, I'll just say it's a good thing that Hinch had a concussion last week or a couple weeks ago because otherwise I wouldn't have been so nice.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's always interesting listening to the blame game, but, you know, Hinch basically said Bell shouldn't have been there. Well, it doesn't matter. He was there, and he was there well before you were, so don't expect him to just drop out of the corner because you want to jump in. It doesn't work like that.
I will say one thing that I liked about what Hinch said.
What's that?
He did say that I will admit to some of the blame.
Yeah, well, that's
nobody good. Else admitted to anything.
Yeah, true. I mean, Townsend Bell, he doesn't have to admit to anything, so he's still running, at least for a little bit.
I think his drive that he did in Global Rallycross,
mm-hmm.
he was trying to take that, didn't he? What? You're not supposed to bounce off of people into turn one? Really?
Really? See, that kind of racing I expected out of Juan Montoya and Jacques Villeneuve, and I didn't get it. What is wrong with this world? I texted Doug during the race. I said Hinchtown population just went down by one.
Oh.
let's see. So we get back underway, and we're moving along. We're getting up to lap 191, and Townsend Bell loses it in turn two. Another hard hit into the wall, but he comes to the stop on the track. But this was right after a debris caution was thrown for part of Sebastian Saavedra's wing was knocked off there in turn two, and it was sitting out in turn two. It didn't cause the accident with Townsend Bell. The Townsend Bell was completely on his own. I'm wondering if something on the car was broken from the previous incident that he World Rally crossed his way through the corner.
Right.
But this brought out one of the most interesting things we've seen at Indy in a long time. There was damage to the safer barrier on the outside of turn two, and they wouldn't start the race again without repairing the damage, meaning it would have finished under yellow. However, instead of that, they employed the red flag, brought the cars to a halt, and fixed everything up and had 7 laps left to run at the end of the race. Thoughts?
It was, under the circumstances, what else could they have done?
Yeah.
It would have taken them longer than the laps they had left to clean up the mess. So if that were the case, then they could have just thrown the checkers right then and there. So calling the red flag and at least letting them shoot it out for the last, what, 6 laps, 7 laps or whatever it was, it was the right call.
I'm going to agree completely. You know, modern technology with these cars, they can, you know, get them started. I mean, stopping them for a little bit and then get them going again isn't going to hurt them any. And, you know, boy, that was a quick welder out there, by the way. It didn't take him long.
No.
I was pretty impressed, actually. I was looking like, holy crap, he's welding together pieces of the safer barrier right off the back of a pickup.
Well, okay, now I will say this. The safer barrier repair that they did on Sunday, I've seen him do other repairs, you know, for other incidents like at NASCAR races and that sort of thing. What they did to repair it, they basically took a piece of sheet metal, you know, plate steel of whatever thickness, and just welded it in place. I've seen when they've done repairs, they actually have sheets of the actual metal skin for the safer barriers that they can weld into place. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any of that, so they used what they had. And, well, he did a good enough job. Yeah. Here's how it looks.
Yeah, it appears so. But, you know, I didn't see this as overly gimmicky. I thought it was still gave a good, fair finish at the end. You know, everybody still had their opportunity. I don't know. I guess sometimes it's a little disappointing when you've got, especially when you got that many laps left. You know, if it was three laps left and they did that, yeah, I think it'd be total gimmick. But nine laps, yeah, no, I can kind of understand that they'd do a red flag for that when there's that much debris.
Yeah. I'll agree with you both. I don't like the idea of green-white checker because it's adding laps to the race and it's too gimmicky for me and whatever. This was the right call, though. It wasn't like they had two laps to go. They had nine laps to go, and they had a good battle going on. There's I can't say that they should have finished under yellow. I would have been disappointed if they finished under yellow. So, right call, yes. Traditionalists may not like it, but it was the right call. Let's see. What else happened in the race? We had Will Power. Heck, he led for quite a while early on in the race. And
that's got to be one of his best oval drives for a long time.
He had a really strong car, too, but he ended up getting a drive-through penalty for speeding in pit lane.
Oh, that's right.
And that pretty much ended his day. We didn't hear from him after that. And let's see, where did he end up finishing? Will Power ended up finishing eighth. Also getting a drive-through for speeding in pit lane was Juan Montoya, and he ended up finishing fifth. So, you know, a few penalties handed around. There's always interesting stuff going on. I remember some pit equipment got hit on pit lane, various other things, but I can't remember who that was. Let's see. Buddy Lazier, yeah, he hit some stuff on pit lane. I think that's what it was, but other than that, you know, like you said, Graham Rahal was first out, and electrical issues. I was kind of surprised by the results of this race, though. I mean, you go down the list of who finished where, and, well, hey, before we do that, what did you think? Personally, I was sitting right there in turn three, there after the restart, and Hunter Ray and Castroneves are dicing back and forth. And there with about, I don't know, 3.5 laps to go, Hunter Ray took an inside move on Elio going into turn three that I thought he was going to end up in the wall.
He clipped the grass to make that freaking move. And yeah. Let me tell you, me and my dad, we're on the edge of our seats watching that battle. And when he went down that low, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this, again, I'm thinking this is a Sato move, yeah. Right? And he sticks it. Wow.
Yeah.
That was just impressive. Just impressive.
I thought he went into the grass when he ducked on the inside. I really did. And when he didn't, when there was no grass kicking up and nothing sliding, I was just blown away.
Yeah, he just barely brushed against the edge of it or something. Wow.
Okay, in the previous Dallara, you never made that pass.
Very true.
You could not take it that low on the track. It wouldn't hold in place. I'm shocked. I am absolutely shocked. You can't pass from the inside lane at full speed going through that corner, but he did. He was on the inside all the way down the backstretch. I'm sitting there watching him. He's on the inside all the way down the backstretch. Ah, That blew me away, gentlemen. I gained a lot of respect for Ryan Hunter-Reay from that move. Clearly, in my opinion, he had the best car bar none. He was passing everybody everywhere on the track throughout the day. He was consistently in the lead, and anytime Elio got around him, he got back in front. Anytime Carpenter got around him, he got back in front.
The only person I know of that seemed like they were up quite a bit there up in the front was actually Marco Andretti of all drivers.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, luck of the Andretti's kicked in, and near the end there, it seems like he just wasn't quite the car that he had a few laps earlier.
Yeah. See, and the pass with 3.5 laps to go was it was instrumental, because if Hunter-Reay would have waited until the front stretch to make that pass with 3 laps to go, then Elio would have got him on the white flag lap.
Yep, it's all about timing with that.
Exactly. So with 3.5 laps to go, that was the best time to do it, because if he waited until the front stretch, it would have been too late. I just super impressive. But the other thing was, when Elio did get around him and then Hunter-Reay slingshotted him again for the win, the interesting thing there was Graham Rahal almost got Hunter-Reay. And if he did, we're talking about a different race winner.
Who almost got him?
Not Graham. Oh, wow. Marco Andretti almost got him.
Oh, right.
Who almost got him?
Like, wait a minute, who?
Mr. Weitzel, you're a bit
of a phantasm of Graham Rahal just showing up on the track. What?
No, indeed. Marco almost got him right there on that backstretch. And like I said, if he did get him, we would have had a different winner to the race. It would have been Elio or possibly even Marco.
Yeah, he had just had to, but Marco just didn't quite have the right spot and had to back off a little bit. But yeah. Boy, backing off just a hair, and he just fell way back.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow.
What was also interesting is when you went into that last lap, Hunter-Reay had actually pulled a sizable distance mm-hmm. between him and Elio. I was actually rather surprised at how far it was coming around that backstretch.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that Hunter-Reay had pace in hand. Or at least had a little bit more than Elio did. It didn't make a whole lot of sense to just go out there and lead the whole race. It made sense to be able to trade spots up there. And obviously towards the end of the race, you want to be able to be the guy in second with 2 to go.
What was interesting is to hear over the radio about during the yellow, I think it was that one of the early yellows, like 25 laps earlier or something like that. To hear Hunter-Reay say that I've got a little something extra over the 25. He didn't say what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is Michael is the one that's playing doing the control for Hunter-Reay, not for Marco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nice. So here it is. You got this, like, his own son. You know, he's right up there, and yet it's Hunter-Reay that he's helping. You know, whatever that little extra. You know, something that he had with the way his car was dialed in, you know, helping Hunter-Reay come out with that win. Just very interesting.
Very cool. So, yeah, coming to the end of the race, though, Ryan Hunter-Reay, a very deserved champion of this event. He was making comments after the race. He said, I could put my car anywhere today. We were running lines that we didn't touch in practice, and it was very clear that he was very happy with the car he had. And then after Elio kind of calmed down after not winning, he had nothing but good things to say as well about Hunter-Reay. And he's just
good sportsmanship all around there, for sure.
Yeah. But yes, Ryan Hunter-Reay with the win, Elio Castroneves in second, and Marco Andretti came home third. Interesting results for Andretti, because Ryan Hunter-Reay finished first, Marco finished third, Munoz finished fourth, Kurt Busch finished sixth. That's 4 Andretti cars in the top 6. Wow.
All with Honda power.
Yeah, yeah. So, pretty impressive results for Andretti. Now going through the other usual suspects, Juan Pablo Montoya was in fifth, Elio Castroneves in second. Sebastian Bourdais with a really good result for him. He's not an Ovalmeister, and finishing seventh at Indy is good. It's a good result.
It's beyond respectable.
Yeah. Will Power in eighth and Sage Karam in ninth.
Sage Karam,
phenomenal.
The only person. Now, one thing we didn't really mention, first of all, is Ryan Hunter-Reay's start position to winning the event.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan Hunter-Reay, he started. What was he in? 19th.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So his starting position was 19th place, and he wins the Indy 500.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only person that moved more spots than Sage Karam, who started 31st and moved into 9th. Oh, wait, wow. No? I guess Sage moved more.
Hmm.
But Sage started in 31st spot.
Yeah, good deal. I mean, now,
that's amazing.
The other thing to point out was J.R. Hildebrand. He had a very good showing this weekend with Ed Carpenter. Parts of the race, they were running 1-2, 2-3, 3-4. They were running together on the track the whole event. And, bad luck on Ed that he ended up getting hinged out of a winning position in this race. He would have been – okay, let's be blunt. He would have been there in the end, but I think Ryan Hunter Ray still wins this race. He just had such a good car, just such a good car. Andretti prepared a fantastic car for him. Anyone else we want to point out? Jacques Villeneuve in 14th. I'm shocked. I'm shocked he didn't wreck anybody.
Yeah.
Well, he did what he needed to do in the fact that stayed out of all the other incidents, just kept running, and didn't have to necessarily go fast and played the attrition game.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess other ones, I guess, to mention what Takuma Sato way back in 19th. Mm-hmm. That's pretty sorry to see after, you know, his performances from seasons past.
Yeah, indeed. Townsend Bell ends up getting into his wreck and being out of the race at the end. He was the 25th spot. 24th was the last running. I shouldn't say last running. Let's see. Tony Kanaan ended up finishing the race after having some pretty rotten suspension issues, but he only had 177 laps. Following him was Pippa Mann, who basically finished last of the people who ran the whole race. She was 7 laps down at the end of this thing, and she should not have been there.
Yeah, that was. I don't know if it was the car, the driver, both. Probably both.
I think it's fair to say that the car was not good, and the driver hasn't done a whole lot lately. So
yeah.
Well, that pretty much wraps up the standings for the Indy 500, gentlemen. We go after Indy, the Drivers' Championship. We have added 143 possible points to the championship for best results. And that now puts Ryan Hunter Ray at 274 points. He's a full 40 points ahead of Will Power in the standings. They came into this event neck and neck. Elio is 220 points. He's back a ways, 54 points behind Ryan Hunter Ray. Simon Pagenaud is still sneaking around up there, but he's down 9 points on Elio. Pretty big change at the top with the points from this race. Though I do have to point out one result from this event that I just had to laugh about. If you go all the way down to 23rd in the championship standings, that is Kurt Busch with 80 points from Indy only, qualifying and race. 1 point ahead of Graham Rahal, who's a full season effort.
Ouch. Wow. Yeah. That tells you not only just a full season effort. How many seasons?
Oh.
How much experience?
Yeah. Let's not go there. Hey, he won Long Beach. He won Long Beach. Get off his back.
Just remember that experience is what you get when you don't get what you want.
Ooh.
Which is wins.
Ooh.
Or finishes in some cases.
Yeah, exactly.
So Ed Carpenter, unfortunately, with the weekend the way it went, he got 43 points from qualifying and 10 points from the race.
You know, I think what's the most painful from this – you know, new points concept is if you DNF, how bad it hurts.
Yeah.
If you just finish, no matter where you finish, you're going to get a boost too. It might make the gaps a little bit bigger, but not really as significant as if you DNF. It is not. It's not just painful. It's a killer.
Yeah,
Scott Dixon. I mean, look at his points now. Scott Dixon, last year's championship. He's at 132 compared to Ryan Hunter Ray at 274.
Yeah.
That's painful.
Indeed, and we've got two more of these events that are a little less points worthy, but Pocono and Fontana are going to be running at 100 points later in the year, and I'm still not entirely sold on the 100 point ovals, but on the other side, I really don't like having the double headers either. So that's just me. All right. That wraps up the IndyCar coverage for this evening. Gentlemen, let's talk about TV ratings for the 500.
we had a 4.0 overnight. We'll wait for the final numbers to come in. That's up 0.2 off of last year. And as Mr. Olsakovsky puts it, is that good enough?
Question, it's out there. Is it enough? Is a 4.0 for Indianapolis sufficient to keep everybody at the corporate level
interested?
Or
what did the NASCAR event get? Do we know?
I didn't even look.
I looked a bunch today and could not find it. So I'm going to make a guess it's right there in that same area because they've just been neck and neck for years.
Okay.
But
I think I would assume that the corporate sponsors would be happy for anything that's right there neck and neck with a NASCAR event then. That's how I would put it.
I would agree. I mean, it's good enough to keep the IndyCar series afloat. If we start getting twos for Indy, then you might as well just start thinking about another hobby, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Because if your crown jewel race that basically supports the rest of the series just starts to dwindle even more than it already has. I mean, the amount that Indy has lost as far as in viewership and that, is more, you can say it is attributed to a lot of different factors. Yes, the split. Yes, dwindling interest. Yes, NASCAR, those sorts of things. But you can also attribute it to the fact that I can watch anything I want on the television.
Exactly. Yep. There is such a, yeah, I mean that's a lot of it right there.
We live in an age where whatever information we want is available to us on demand anymore.
Instantly, yep.
I had a discussion with somebody talking about bringing the Indianapolis 500 back to its level of prominence, and I argued it can never come back to the level of prominence that it once was, simply because 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you didn't have all the other things, all the other distractions, all the other forms of entertainment that you have today, whether it's cable TV channels, the internet, video games, whatever. Yeah. 30 years ago, you had three networks. You watched something on one of those three networks. And if you didn't do that, you went outside.
Yeah, that's exactly
that's
true.
That's about it.
That's exactly true. So, for the long-term future and health of IndyCar, is four enough? I don't know. Is four enough to keep this series afloat for now? Yeah, it is. But with the continued insurgence of, anything you want to do, you can do on your tablet computer, this, that, and the other, on your cell phone or what have you. I mean, I agree with some of the other series that you have to think up new ways to engage fans.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to think up ways that you can keep people entertained and invested into an event that they're not really interested in watching the whole thing. Yep. So, I don't know. I don't know where it goes from here. The occasional
– I think under the climate, a four for the overnight for the Indy 500, I think is a good number. I think the numbers that they had for the two qualifying days were good numbers for what was being shown.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the ratings are about as good as they can get under the circumstances.
And actually, I will say that, they're this year with their level of commitment to showing a lot more stuff on the networks, from showing the practices, the qualifying, some of it on ABC and some of it on NBC Sports, showing the pit challenge thing, which you normally just got a little highlight during the preview of the Indy 500. You never actually got to see that on television. They're bringing a lot of the stuff back that maybe years ago we used to see. I think they're really kind of helping build up that month of May excitement for the Indy 500 this year that they didn't do in years past for a while. And I'm thankful for it, and I think that build-up helps that rating. But this is the first year I think I saw such an expansion.
Yeah.
Okay, gentlemen, let's jump forward. Rookie of the Year. Do you agree that Kurt Busch is Rookie of the Year? That's who got voted.
I think it's a popularity contest, and that's how he won. Or the fact that he just happened to be the highest placing of the quote-unquote rookies.
Yeah.
My opinion is he's a person that's driven high-speed ovals on a regular basis in traffic. Yes, not an open wheel. But understanding how the grip of a car works under those conditions, under high speed, is very different from my pick would have been Sage Karam. Sage Karam is the first driver in the Indy 500 who's done every step of the ladder program from Indy from the USF 2000 up to Indy Lights and into the Indy 500. He moved from 31st place to finish 9th. He was, you know, right up there in the top five at times. Maybe he's even up there like a second place for a little bit. You know, he showed phenomenal driving for a 19-year-old kid. How much more rookie can you get than a 19-year-old competing with the big guys?
The boy who skipped his high school prom to qualify for the Indy 500.
Exactly. I don't see how you could pick somebody else, but because it is a popularity contest. It apparently went Bush.
I don't even think it's necessarily a popularity contest. I think it's as simple as Kurt Busch was the highest finishing rookie. End of story.
Yeah.
I don't agree with the decision either. It certainly would have been my pick. I agree with you, Mike, that Sage Karam certainly is more deserving, but you know, he got outpaced at the end by Kurt Busch and that was it.
Yeah. All right. Go to the race.
Yeah.
John, who do you call the GOAT?
Ooh, that's got to be a tough one. I Plowman for living up to his name. I hate to say it. That was rough.
Yeah.
I didn't want it to be Plowman, but it is.
Yeah.
You know, the GOAT car of the race was apparently Graham Rahal, but the GOAT driver of the race. Plowy, if you listen to this, dude, I still love you, man, but you had a crappy 500, dude. he was not only did he, plow into New Garden, but he was in the way multiple times of lead drivers and had a tough time getting out of the way. I know his car was handling crappy and it probably wasn't fun. I did see though him do the right thing at the very end when we were down to after that restart, you know, with the niner laps or so, and they were catching up to him and he dove in on that infield runoff and got out of the way of the leaders, and he did the right thing there. But he just had a terrible, terrible run. And, yeah, I think, like you said, Weitzel, there were times that you were thinking, why didn't they send a flag and kind of pull him off course? It was kind of that bad.
Yeah. I will vote for my GOAT of the race. And I had a hard time because Plowman, yeah, he had a bad one. Pippa Mann also had a bad weekend, just didn't have the equipment or, you know, what have you. I could go for Hinch because I kind of think that he's the one that caused that whole mess and ended up taking out some quality cars, including himself. Because if Hinch didn't take out that mess, he would have been another Andretti in the top 10.
Yeah.
I agree.
But I'll tell you, nobody really rises to the level of GOAT as much as that freaking gimp suit in the bathtub. That's the GOAT of the race. That was poorly done. All right, gentlemen, next up, we have a doubleheader in Detroit coming up this weekend on ABC. Tune into your local listings to find out when you can watch on ABC because, you know, it's on ABC.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. What channel? What network is on?
The Always Bad Coverage Network.
And if you do catch it at some point, the Pirelli World Challenge is going to be there too, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, they're in action this weekend as well. And that squeezes out the Mazda Road to Indy ladder series from competing in that event because they fill it up with everything. I think they've got, you know, the Grand Am whatever, United Sports Car Blendification Series there.
Stadium trucks?
Maybe.
Okay, I do have to say that.
And that might be the best race of the weekend.
Well, will their pieces of track be tearing up?
Hopefully not.
Yeah.
Hopefully not.
I will say that, you know, Friday or Saturday? I think it was Friday where they had the stadium trucks, right? And they had those running out there at Indy. I caught just a little bit of it because they web streamed it. And it was so terrible.
Oh, was it?
What?
Oh, it was so bad.
I've watched a few of those events, like at Long Beach and at St. Petersburg, and I think it's a blast to watch those trucks because they're going around hairpins and 90-degree corners and everything, and they're up on three wheels. They're just doing everything they can to steer with one wheel on the ground.
That was partially true. You saw some of that, but it looked like total chaos out there. Like, because it wasn't a dedicated track, right? They're just going off of some of the infield. They set up a ramp to like jump over some of like the infield barricade stuff, you know, and it just looked so hokey. It's like, oh, well, look, they got to go around this barrel, but then somebody hits the damn barrel or what, you know. Mm. It was like it was just kind of set up like last minute and didn't look very coordinated and
looked kind of like Global Rallycross last year.
Before it was organized, yes.
Or there's 1X Games that they just did such a bad job. They did it in the LA Coliseum, and they kept changing the track, and people won their heat because they were up against somebody who totally forgot the course.
Right.
Oh, well, next up is ABC next weekend, and that wraps up our IndyCar coverage for this evening. All right, now that we've wrapped up the Indy 500 and all its glory, let's jump directly into the Mazda Road to Indy, the Mazda Road to Indy Freedom 100, USF 2000, Pro Mazda at IRP, and we also have some discussion about the new Indy Lights chassis. And to take us through all of those, Doug Patterson is kind enough to join us by phone this evening because he is in bandwidth hell. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thank you. No, I'm still here in Indiana, visiting friends, family, and here in Anderson, and my bandwidth is limited to the cell phone. But I am having one of my uncle's very fantastic whiskey slushes, so all is right and proper with the world.
So you're not doing Miller time this week?
No. I gotta apologize. I got that wrong. It's been sponsored by Miller for so long. I didn't even think about it. But of course, the sponsorship had changed this year, and it was the Coors Light Carb Day, not the Miller Light Carb Day. Not that one could actually tell a difference in a blind taste test.
Cold down easy.
I will say that I have been known to slam a Coors Light or two after coming in off the mower on a hot summer day. I will admit to that.
Isn't that the only way you can tolerate one?
Yeah, pretty much. They got to be ice cold.
I mean, that's absolutely true.
They can't be refrigerated. They have to be fresh out of the freezer.
There you go. There, it's quite refreshing, but not in mass quantities. Anyway, moving forward,
right.
Doug, take us through it, man.
Well, let's start at IRP, ORP, LORP, PR,
CIP. The racetrack, formerly known as.
We should just have an unpronounceable symbol. But anyway, so at the night before the 500, of course, the traditional USF 2000 and Pro Mazda races. This year, the USF 2000 series is only running one oval, and that was at IRP. And Pro Mazdas are running two. I'm trying to remember where the Pro Mazda is running their second, I want to say it's at Milwaukee.
Yes.
But anyway, their first solo of the season was Lucas Oil Raceway. I think they've dropped the Raceway Park.
Oh.
I think it's just LOR now. But anyway, unfortunately, I had family obligations on Saturday night, and so I had to miss the event. I was bummed. Not having you as an excuse, I gotta go join Mr. Weitzel. That didn't help disengage me from the obligations. So unfortunately, I missed the races. However, I talked to Peter Portante during Carb Day. Met up with him there. That was pretty cool. And then met him again on race day during the tweet up. He and his teammate at Arms Up Motorsports, Aaron Tellett, they were there. Got to talk with them for a little bit. And Arms Up had a very, very nice race setup. Unfortunately, they did not have a very, very good qualifying setup. They've been strong in testing and practice. They had missed setup in qualifying. They had a lot of understeer. And, Peter was telling you going into the corner, you turn the wheel and oh, crap, nothing's happening. And so it was a little dicey. But, you know, so their qualifying positions weren't fantastic. I think it was 6th for Aaron and 12th for Peter. But the reason I'm focusing on them as opposed to our championship leader, R.C. Enerson, R.C. Enerson did not have a good night at the 5/8 mile oval. Meanwhile, the Arms Up boys, they had things dialed in. And Peter quickly clawed his way up from his 12th spot. Didn't make it up as far as he had liked, but he did win the little camera? The Replay XD? Am I remembering the brand right?
Yeah.
The move of the race. It was their, you know, every race they have. They have an award for the Replay XD move of the race. And well, that went to Peter for a very, very nice pass on the outside. Trying to remember who it was against, but he was right in between a competitor and the wall, a little light contact with both, but squeezed through and made the pass successfully and kept it going. And Aaron just started picking off competitors one by one until he was at the front and pulling away. And so Aaron wins his first USF 2000 race, and it was the first race win for Arms Up Motorsports. So very good on them. What this does for the championship is it really closes the gap up front, but Enerson still holds the lead as the series now looks at a pretty significant summer break. So everybody gets June, July off, and they will race again at Mid-Ohio. Mm-hmm. They're beginning of August. And got tickets ordered. I was a little late. Didn't get the discount.
No.
I was tardy paying for it, I know. But I still got the infield parking pass, so I'm happy.
Sweet.
Yep.
That's
so,
all that matters.
Looking forward. Yes, it is. That, I tell you what, that's the best money that you can spend in motorsport right there. Is the infield parking pass at Mid-Ohio. That is brilliant. But anyway, so looking forward to that. But it is an awful long way away. Awful long way away. In the Pro Mazda, you know, we got very used in the first few events of Spencer Pigot of Funkos Racing just running away with the field, right? Just blowing the doors off everyone. Didn't go so well at the Grand Prix, but he was able to maintain the championship lead. He did not win at IRP either, or LOR, whatever. He didn't win the night before the 500. He did run a very strong race and had a tough battle that he would eventually come out the worst. Well, not, I shouldn't say the worst for. It came out on the losing end of a battle for position right at the end, put him in third spot instead of second. And Garrett Grist just had a masterful race, winning his. Was that Garrett Grist's first race, I believe, or first race win, I believe it was, for Andretti Autosport, and just did a bang up job. So good on Garrett. And Scott Hargrove was P2 finisher. So Hargrove closes the gap a little bit, but third place finish by Pigot keeps him in the points lead as they move forward. Now the race that really everybody should have been looking forward to was the Freedom 100 on Carburation Day. I don't know how many times I have to tell people and have a race like this, happen before people start to believe me that the best racing action during the month of May is this Freedom 100. It was another absolutely magnificent race. And if you remember what I was saying before, that yes, Razia and Harvey for Schmidt-Peterson Motorsport were very strong at the Grand Prix, right? And had very strong cars. It looked like Schmidt had it back together again. A Grand Prix circuit is one thing. Racing on the 2.5 mile Indianapolis Motor Speedway oval is quite another. And I thought, oh, well, crap, maybe I spoke too soon, because in qualifying on Thursday, Razia put it on pole. Was there watching as Zach Veach came in. Thought he had a decent time until he saw the subsequent times come in, and was just crestfallen. He would end up in the second row alongside his teammate, but Gracia and Jack Harvey of Schmidt-Peterson, they would occupy the first row. However, qualifying is not racing, and you have three really good drivers, experienced oval drivers, and especially Veach and Chavez, who have raced in these machines on this oval previously. Chavez, of course, is especially hungry, right? Because he was involved last year in that four-wide finish that we saw for the Freedom 100 in 2013 that Peter Dempsey won by one nose, literally. It was measured in 0.010 of a second. So racing or qualifying on an oval and racing on an oval, very, very, very different. So even though the Schmidt boys were up front in row one, you had some very talented and experienced oval racers right behind them. Yeah, Brabham has not raced these machines on this oval, but he has raced on ovals before in USF 2000 and in Pro Mazda. So, you know, even though the speeds are higher, the track is bigger, the primary concepts are not different. And, of course, Veach and Chavez, they have ample experience with these machines at this track. In fact, Chavez was involved in that epic four-wide finish last year. That thinking about that finish still gives me goosebumps. And so it didn't take long for Chavez and Veach and Brabham to pull out ahead of the Schmidt-Peterson duo. And they would duke it out for the remainder of the race. A relatively incident-free race. We're used to having some pretty nasty, you know, multi-car incidents in the lights race, people getting into each other and what all else. And we did have one incident, but by and large, the race was very, very clean this year. But Chase Austin, who is in the number 40, or I'm sorry, in the number zero for Ballardi Auto Racing, had this was the most wicked loose car I think I've ever seen at the speedway. Mike, did you see that?
No, unfortunately, I did not.
Okay, well this was the weirdest thing. So he starts his turn in to turn one, right? And all of a sudden the car is a little wiggly. Catches it, brings it in again. Car is a lot more wiggly, and he is struggling just to get this car back underneath him, right? Because it is literally starting to go all over the place. Eventually, it hooks, and it just dives towards the inside of the track. Well, he's not even through turn one yet, you know. So normally these understeer turning into snap oversteer type of things, they usually end up with you on the outside wall at the exit of turn one, right? Well, this, it was so loose, he just hooked it right into the inside of the corner and slammed straight into the photog area there on the inside of the south chute. It was a brutal hit, absolutely brutal hit. Fortunately, Chase came away with just a broken wrist, fractured wrist. It was an ugly hit. There was now I mentioned I hit a photographer's area, an area that I was at just the day before at that very very location where debris had struck one of the photographers square in the face. He had a pretty significant nose injury and was taken to the hospital from the track where he stayed. I believe he stayed overnight. He would be fine. Messed up nose, which it could have been a lot worse. So, but it's, you know, it's just a reminder, not just to us photographers who are working the track, but even to spectators, because that area right behind where us photographers are working, is a grandstand. And so, you know, that debris, you know, wasn't that far away from, you know, being capable of hitting a spectator. So whether you're working a track or whether you're there as a spectator, keep your head on a swivel. You know, things get sketchy pretty quick. So, but you know, injuries, but none severe, thankfully. And then they got the race back underway, and the trio, you know, the Andretti Autosport duo and Gabby Chavez took off again. and they just swapped race lead and battled back and forth for the remainder of the race, and it looked like
it was interesting. What I got to watch the last 15 laps because my DVR was recording. I got to watch the last 15 laps. And my DVR was recording actually the Indy, because it's set to record IndyCar stuff, and apparently it bled over into, with the yellow flag and stuff, over into what was going to be the pit stop challenge, and I didn't realize the Indy Lights was kind of smashed in between a couple of different things that they were covering. Anyway, so I cut the last 15, and boy, yeah, those three, it was interesting to watch probing for when the right time would be to pass or make the move on the final lap. You could see that little testing. Should I do it here? Should I do it there? You know, and it kind of just went back and forth. It was very interesting to watch that.
You know, and this is why oval racing is so much like a chess game. You know, there is so much more that goes into oval racing than most people think. Well, you don't just turn left. And even, okay, yeah, you have more driving dynamics than that. But then you have the mind game that you're playing with your opponent. You know, chess maybe is the wrong game analogy. Poker might be the better analogy for how all this happens on an oval. You're testing your opponent. You're looking for where they're weak. You're looking, where can I make this move? Where can I convince my opponent that I'm going to make a move? Make him make a mistake, and then capitalize on that mistake. You know, so there's all these, you know, multiple levels of thought. What do I think that my opponent's going to do? What do I think my opponent thinks that I'm going to do? And it's really, really deep. And you saw a lot of that in those last 15 laps. And so, you know, the whole jockeying for position and passing and fainting a pass, and then, you know, it was magnificent. And they all ran close, but very, very clean. It was very nice to see. In the end, come around the turn four, and it was Brabham in front, and Chavez had come around. He had held the outside line in turn three, and that was the key. And of course, this was the key last year with Peter. Mm-hmm. He knew if he could hold that outside line, get a much better run off the turn corner in turn four. You carry more speed down the straight. If your car would stick on that outside line, Chavez knew his would, and he edged Brabham by the quarter length of the front wing. What was it?
It was about 6 inches that he won by.
Yeah, they only went two wide this year instead of four wide, so you know, they kind of let us down.
Oh yeah, you know, let us down with a 6-inch win. Yeah, you know.
And a brilliant pass.
Yeah, it was good to see Chavez win. You know, I would have been happy to see, you know, any three of those kids win. They both fought like hell for it, and it would have been a real good feel good story for any of the three. But of course, for Chavez, having come so close last year, being so hungry for it this year, and winning in the car that beat him last year, right?
Yeah, indeed.
You know, because he won this year in the number 5 Bilardi machine that Peter Dempsey drove last year.
Oh, that's ironic.
So, yeah, that's two in a row for Bilardi. Two in a row for that car. It's good to be the number 5. I may have to switch my solo racing number from 42 to 5. Maybe that'll help my luck this year. But anyway, that's it. It's a brilliant race, and that actually puts Chavez in the lead by a point.
one point.
Amazing.
Over Zach Veach. So now they go, I believe, their next race is Pocono.
Okay.
And so they get June off, and they go to Pocono and race on the Tricky Triangle.
Yep.
Nice. Yep.
And so, again, I think, you know, this oval racing experience is going to be crucial. But I think the Schmidt-Peterson duo, especially Razia, you could see him starting to figure it out here at the Freedom 100. He was really pestering Zach Veach there at the end. Zach held him off and kept third, but you could tell that Razia was starting to figure some things out and starting to get a lot more racy there in the closing lap. So I'm not looking forward to trying to make a pick for the Pocono race.
Yeah. One of those three. How about that?
Well, one of those four.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
You know,
yeah.
And I think Jack Harvey is still, he needs another oval or two to really get things sorted. But, I mean, you got the Andretti Autosport duo, you've got Gabby Chavez, and now it looks like Luis Razia, who put their names in the hat and pull it out. And it's just, I think it's going to come down to who pulls the car off the truck with the best initial setup.
Hmm.
Well, Doug, who's going to be closest to the mark, you know, when they pull them off the truck.
Well, Doug, did you get a chance to lay eyes on the new Indy Lights chassis that they were parading around this weekend?
It looked gorgeous.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
It looked expensive. You know, there's a lot of very positive things. There's a number of things that that team owners are going to cringe about. They're going to have to get new wheels. Motegi, of course, is a sponsor now. Motegi wheels. They had Oz Racing wheels before. And so they'll have to get a new set of wheels, the new chassis, of course, all new engines. They'll have the pushed pass 50 horsepower over and above the 450 that they're going to have on their, I don't have the spec sheet here in front of me, but it's a small displacement turbo. I believe it's an inline four turbo. I said, don't quote me on it here. I'm on remote location right now, so I don't have my info in front of me. I'll be writing up an article looking at all the bits. I took some close-ups of the diffuser and the strakes and the little fiddly aero bits all over the place. So
are they going to use the same aero package, whether it's oval or whether it's street?
Probably.
Okay. That'll keep costs down, obviously.
Right. And that has worked really well for the Indy Lights guys. It's a matter of you basically keep the same basic wing configuration, but you can add or remove elements.
Okay.
You know, as opposed to the IndyCar, where, it's a completely different wing package.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the whole front and the whole rear are completely different.
You keep the primary main planes, and, maybe you add a secondary element, for the road and street. But anyway, it looks like a really nice package. It could be a very racy package. The big question is, how will the financials work out?
Yeah.
Financials work out correctly? I've been, the scuttlebutt is that we may see some long-standing teams not be so standing anymore.
Yeah.
But then you've also got some other people who are likely to come in. So it's a mix.
Well, I have
it all depends on how well they can market, especially to the European teams and drivers, so they can get more participation.
Now, don't they also have a new? If you do win the Indy Lights Championship, don't they have actually a new offer?
Yes,
with the new chassis.
Guaranteed three races, including the Indianapolis 500.
Now that's huge.
And yeah, it is. It's not terribly different than what they have now. You can get a partial season or the 500. And of course, Sage took his money and some sponsors and some other partners that he was able to bring online and secure his 500 race or 500 drive. But this is going to be a guarantee. I believe it was three total races and the Indianapolis 500 mile race. So yeah, it's a good scholarship for the series winner. Let's just hope that the participation comes up. Like I said, there's a lot of really positive things. There's a lot of things that the team owners are going to grumble about too.
All right. Well, two quick things before we let you go, Doug, but two things we asked about during the Indy 500 segment would be who was your Indy Rookie of the Year?
Sage Karam.
Sage Karam.
And I'll defend that. When you look at Busch, yes, it's his first time in an Indy car.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he did have an outstanding month of May. I do not take that away from him, okay? And you know, it, but it's more than just, how did you, you know, who placed the highest on track? If that were it, there would be no need to vote.
Yeah.
Right?
Indeed.
There would be no need to vote. You look at the whole package. And I think in terms of someone who's, who's the rookie that you want to hold up and say, here is the future of this race and of this racing series. You are not holding up Kurt Busch.
Yeah, right. And you know, one thing that they've done in the past was they did kind of a co-rookies of the year deal. I think that was when Alex Baron was in. So I could see that being a good way of going this year as well. But you know,
I could have gone for co. But when you really think you want to elevate somebody and say, here is the rookie that going forward, this guy is going to be someone to watch out for. This is the future of our race and our series. It's hands down. You're looking at Sage. You're not looking at Kurt.
Okay. Second question. Go to Vindy.
Townsend Bell.
No way. Really?
My.
Wow.
Yes. Really.
Wow.
No. Okay. Okay. You're going three wide, right? And everything. Oh, it's just a bold move. I'm sorry. It's 25 laps to go for the Indianapolis 500-mile race. If you don't make that move, you will never be a winner.
So then why is Townsend Bell the GOAT there? Because he was on the racing line, just the high line. Pinch was not on the racing line.
Townsend Bell was there first.
And he was there first. Okay. That's true. He was ahead.
So? He was still way high. There is no way he was going to hold that high line all the way around. There's no way that was going to happen.
There is if Hinchcliffe didn't show up.
Exactly. That's even Ed Carpenter himself said. Carpenter himself said, I could have been racing fine with Bell right there. It was Hinch sticking his nose where it shouldn't have been.
No. They could not have run at the line that they both were. They would both have to have come down, and they would have to get it sorted out for turn two. Turn two, there's only a car width and a half. You couldn't run too wide turn two or through turn four.
Then discretion being the better part of valor, Hint should have said, they can't make that, and if I stick my nose there, they won't make that. So maybe I should stay back here.
Hinch did stick his nose in, and, well, we see what happened.
Hinch stuck his nose in. He had a good run. He had a great run on the two. And Townsend Bell is like, he should have been thinking, oh, crap, I've been hung out to dry. I can't hang up here. You know, I can be one lane lower and make it, but I can't be out here on this third lane and make it around this corner. I'd better back off. My car is compromised anyway. The toe on his right or left rear was way out. He knew his car was compromised. And so, no, I still say it was on Townsend to recognize that there was two inside, that he was going to be stuck out on that very high line, and that there was no way that he was going to be able to hold that withdraw. Because, you know, I'm sorry, if you're going to say in the closing laps of the 500, you're like, no, it's too risky, I don't think I'll do it, you're never going to do
so
it.
You can say that exact thing for Bell then, so then it cancels each other out.
No, because there's a difference, okay?
Really?
Had
their positions been reversed? Had their positions
had
been Townsend reversed?
Had Bell been an Indy Lights driver and...
No, had Townsend Bell been on the inside line, he could have held that line all the way through. And you know, there's a difference between a risky move and a move with zero chance of success.
Yes, displayed by Hinchcliffe.
Being up on that third line, there is no chance for success.
Well, it seemed like to me when they were normally going too wide down through there, the two cars that would normally be side by side would have been about where Townsend Bell and Ed Carpenter were. And those two would move progressively down together. And you can see the rubber was down. That was a typical line that actually Bell was on and moving down in with normally Ed would move in conjunction with him, right? It's just the fact that Hinch was there. And I don't know. I think Hinch was too fast at the far end of that straight there going into that corner. Or being down that low, that I'm not sure if he would have held it. I think he would have sawed.
No, I don't think so. And bring up another point. What was Townsend Bell's spotter doing?
I don't know what his spotter was doing.
Yeah, you know, okay, because Bell said he had no clue that Hinch was down there. And I have to ask, why the hell not?
Well, Hinch said he had no clue Bell was on top.
You can't see. Well, and that's another problem. And so, you know, I will say, you know, that, yeah, okay, you can't see yourself down there. That's why you have someone up on top of standee, you know, looking and spotting for you. Hey, you got two inside. You know, and with Hinch's spotter, hey, you got two outside. Well, Hinch knew that there was two outside, right? He should have seen him coming. And so, I don't know. But yeah. I'm sticking with Townsend Bell if I go to the race.
Okay, we will affirm you and your choice of Townsend Bell, however we disagree. Anyway.
Yeah, I was saying plowing myself.
Oh, yes.
He did some serious plowing.
Yes, he did.
That's a whole other thing.
All right.
He had some better races, that's for certain.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, he's a nice guy. You know, he's a friend of the show, but not a good 500.
This was not one of his best races.
Well, gentlemen, we need to move on and talk about the Monaco GP briefly. However, that means
and
it's the time of the
show. And don't tell me because I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, and that means it's the time of the show when we hang up on Doug. Everybody say yay!
Good night.
Good night, Doug. All right, and now we'll jump quickly into the Formula One coverage for this evening. Yes, the grandest Grand Prix of them all, the Monaco Grand Prix, was this weekend. We got to see the shots of sheer opulence, photo opportunities from inside the Monaco casino that just looks like they've painted the ceiling with the winnings of all the many, many years of the broken hearts who have played there. We got to see the yachts and the glitz and the glamour and another really crappy race.
I mean, yeah. it is the Grand Parade of Monaco.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one race that you have to watch the qualifying.
Yeah,
you must watch the qualifying because that is the race. Pretty much how qualifying ends up, that is pretty much how it's going to probably finish. Not necessarily 100% of the time, but pretty close to that, right?
Well, it's pretty much you could consider it the unofficial results.
There you go, yes.
And
yes,
the way
sure.
The FIA changes the results of a race after the race is over, I mean, you'd be pretty close.
You would be very close.
But speaking of qualifying left one Lewis Hamilton a little upset because Nico Rosberg went out and put up quick time. And then when Lewis was on a flyer, Nico Rosberg just kind of pulled off to the side of track and parked it.
Well, it wasn't quite that simple. He had cooked the brakes. He had locked up.
It wasn't quite Schumacher-esque at Mirabeau, but...
right.
But, yeah, he had cooked it, and I think it's fair to say he in his mind, he's like, do I risk maybe hitting the wall and, you know, throwing this whole thing away, or do I just kind of ease it into
the corner? Go into the runoff.
Yeah, let's go into the runoff. It's discretion, the better part of valor on this one. Let's make sure that we're here to run the race, and if the stewards don't like it, you know, they can penalize me, but they can't put me all the way at the back.
Now, here's the thing that I didn't quite understand, though, from that situation is he was completely in the runoff, clear of the course, and they still yellow flag that section.
Yeah, that's...
okay, yeah, you didn't have a runoff area for the other guy. Fine. But, if you're playing odds, I guess, I don't know. I thought that section should not have been yellow flagged if he is completely off course.
Yeah, well...
Because during a race, would it have been yellow flagged if he was off course there and out of the way?
Possibly.
Yeah. Well, if he was off the course, but, you know, they would probably do a local yellow until the car was moved out of harm's way, out of the runoff area. You see crazy stuff at Monaco. Like in this race, there's one car that was dead on the track right there before you go into pit entry on the inside lane. And you see this swarm of 7 or 8 track workers out there under yellow flag conditions. They're in one lane. The other lane is active with cars whizzing by at you know, yellow
flags. They're slowing down to 100.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Oh, sheesh. Freaks me out. You know, I agree that Formula One is safe, but it is safe because of the track layouts that they designed. It is safe because of the cars that they've designed, but I'll tell you, it is not safe with how they do the yellow flags in a lot of instances. And at Monaco, it is especially true. And you saw that with the cars whizzing by as they're swarming over this one car trying to get it.
Trying to get the crane hooked up so the crane can take it out of there. Yeah.
So Nico Rosberg ended up on pole, Lewis Hamilton second, Daniel Ricciardo qualified third, and Vettel qualified fourth. Huh.
Repeat.
Fernando fifth in his basically given qualifying position for the season.
Yeah, exactly.
Raikkonen qualified sixth, and really that's all I'm going to talk about.
So those top six in the qualifying, that's kind of the rinse and repeat for the season.
It really has. You know, it's been segmented by teams, and occasionally you'll see like a McLaren or somebody else pop up there, Force India. But for the most part, that's where they've been holding. The stewards did look into the whole deal with Nico Rosberg, but they allowed him to keep his pole, which further alienated Lewis Hamilton, and he just went on his own little private hatred tour this weekend because he did not agree with anybody who thought that Nico Rosberg should win a race over him.
When
I went to Tosche Station, pick up some power converters. You know, Nico ended up winning this race from pole, and really there is nothing that could have kept him from winning other than technical issues with this car. The car's fast. Lewis was not demonstrably faster than him anywhere right. all weekend long.
Even though he started catching up to him a little bit at the end there, or no, I guess that was Ricardo catching up to Hamilton
yeah.
at the end, wasn't it?
But
still, I mean, catching and passing are two completely different things with this game.
Especially at Monaco. There's nowhere to pass. I mean, you see it all the time. People pass by mutual understanding at Monaco. Like, you saw several passes down there in the hairpin. I think Adrian Sutil was making a bunch of passes. And they're at the casino hairpin. And you go in – or, sorry, the Fairmont. Hairpin, but you go into that hairpin, and if you're on the inside, the other person basically says, I don't want damage to my car, so I'm going to agree that I'll let you by. That's yep. pretty much what happens, because otherwise yeah. there's nowhere to pass. Nowhere.
No room. Yep.
So Nico ended up winning the race easily over his teammate. However, you know, with all the yellows and, well, you had a safety car period at which, during the safety car period, we heard a little bit more of the, I want to go to Tosche Station and pick up the power converter. Yeah. Lewis was not happy with his team. You guys should have brought me in a lap earlier because I told you I needed new tires and you didn't agree with me and you wouldn't let me come in, and now look what happened.
Right.
You had to come in and pit under yellow. So what? That's what happens.
Yeah, that I love that. That was the Hamilton was like, I knew we should have, you know, pitted the lap before or whatever. Really? You can anticipate a yellow coming out? Okay, let's put on our ESP helmets and figure that out.
In the end, he's not leading the race, so he doesn't get the preferential treatment on pit stop position. If he had damaged tires, maybe the team would have changed their mind and brought him in immediately. But he didn't have damaged tires, and they weren't going to compromise his teammate's race just so he could win. And that's really what he was trying to do. He was trying to get the better pit strategy before his teammate did. Anyway, he was unhappy with the strategy call. He was unhappy with his cheating teammate. And it's just how the race went. Kimi's race was kind of ruined. He got a hole shot at the start of the race. He got up to third. And then he had to come in and pit and was racing well, but he came into pit and they put on new tires, and then he came out and had a puncture immediately and had to come in and change tires again.
Yeah.
Kind of sucked. Vettel's car was crap this weekend. He had turbo issues and all kinds of other stuff going on, and his race was ruined by that. And once again, Daniel Ricciardo beats his teammate. It's getting to be an issue here, gentlemen. It's almost like Daniel Ricciardo joined the team. He has the Aussie spunk, but he doesn't have the Aussie's car.
Right. Yeah, no, it's like he's got Vettel's car.
Indeed.
As far as reliability goes. And I can understand Vettel has every right to be extremely upset and angry to have mechanical or software issues. It seems like actually it's software issues that he's been having such a problem plaguing him.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things he said that, you know, like, you know, we can be fast. You know, I can be fast up there. And for me to be, you know, from where I am to being up at the top, you know, very well could be as simple as a single line of code. You know, somebody clicks a mouse button.
Yeah.
And then we're up there. Just finding out where the hell that is. You know,
the thing that I have to wonder, though, is if Vettel is supposed to be the number one at Red Bull, then are they giving him the newest, you know, the newest pieces straight out of engineering, straight out of the lathes or whatever to put on his car? And is that what's causing it to fail? Is it something that he is doing as a driver that just over revs the car or creates some other mechanical issue within the systems in the car, or is he just getting the garbage, you know, the cast off
seconds
that are failing?
You know, I think that I think he's getting all the new stuff and all that, whether that's good or bad. I think his driving style with this new package doesn't work as well. You know, he's talked about how he likes to really just drive a car, you know, to its limits. Well, this car actually has limits that are even lower tolerance because less downforce and more torque. So you got to be a little bit nicer to it, but to keep it on its limit. Sure. I think he just could just before he could just mash it and just go. And in, on top of that, with all the technical bits, there's a lot more busy stuff you got to do in the car to keep it at top performance. And I'm wondering just that something Ricardo is just a little more natural and better at doing right now. Mm. Not to mention the reliability issues. Obviously, Vettel's had those as well. So whether that has something to do with it also, I'm not sure. You know, Vettel gets the latest software update. And you know how software updates go. Oh, whoops, shouldn't have released that one. It's got a bug in it.
The thing is, though, we don't know. We don't really have a clear picture on as far as which one of them at Red Bull is actually the better driver, because Ricardo's results have been better, certainly. But Vettel has had some good drives that and it's just been plagued by mechanicals. So we don't have a clear picture as far as which one is truly the number one as far as driving talent and ability.
You know what this is, though, John? It's 4 years of karma coming home to roost. So the results of the race, Nico Rosberg won, Lewis Hamilton finished second, and he finished about 9 seconds clear of his teammate. Daniel Ricciardo was like 9.6 seconds back of Nico Rosberg, so he was about 0.4 seconds behind Lewis there at the end. Good battle going into the end of the race, but we pretty much knew that there wasn't going to be a pass. Fernando finished 32 seconds behind the leader, and that was the end of the people on the lead lap. Everybody else after that finished on the second lap. Nico Hulkenberg finished for fifth for Force India. Good result for him. McLaren, Jenson Button in sixth, probably their first points paying position in a very long time. Felipe Massa finished seventh. Romain Grosjean, eighth. Jules Bianchi in the Marussia scores their very first point ever.
Wow.
Because there's a lot of attrition. 15th on was, well, they did not place. 15th on were out of the race. So very interesting results. Kevin Magnussen also finished in the points for McLaren. It is Monaco. It's kind of annoying. It's kind of not a good race, but it's still fun to watch because you never know when some Finn is going to get angry with this car and park it and go drink a beer on a yacht or something. It's always fun.
Bring the gorilla suit.
Yeah. So Nico Rosberg recaptured the championship lead with 122 points, 4 points ahead of Lewis Hamilton, and Fernando Alonso is fully half that at 61. So, yeah, there's your championship. It's between Nico and Lewis. That's the drama we get this season. And the way Lewis is acting this time of year, it's going to be just like a soap opera going through the rest of the season or the beginning of episode 4, A New Hope. Mercedes is at 240 points in the Constructors' Championship. Red Bull is at 99, Ferrari at 78. Insurmountable is what I would call that lead.
Yeah. It's accurate.
Mercedes got it. They got it. They got it right. And the teams are going to be struggling hard not to be thrashed as badly next season as they have been this season.
The thing is, it's not just that Mercedes got it right from the beginning of the season. Mm-hmm. What they got right was so significant and had such a cascading effect on other systems of the car, the way they split up their turbo, mm-hmm. the way they did. There's so many other benefits from running in that system and getting that right. I don't think there's anything any of the other teams can do to come close, let alone catch them and compete.
Not until they do a significant change to their power units, because you know, the way it is right now, they're not only the fastest, but they're also conserving the most fuel.
And they have better aero because of the tighter compact design. Yeah, I mean. I don't see all of the advantages they're getting from what Mercedes did in the offseason. I don't see anybody being able to catch up. They may be able to catch up in one thing and make a little bit of improvement, but so many benefits come from the packaging of their turbo, nobody's going to be able to catch up.
Yeah. Now, as far as going on and finishing the rest of the season, winning every race for Mercedes, I see that as a possibility, but I don't think it's going to happen, especially with Lewis and Nico being as tight in the championship as they are. There's going to be a coming together somewhere, and it's going to be calamitous for the team.
Yeah.
Very true.
Speaking of calamity, Tony Fernandez is supposedly putting up his team for sale. Caterham is on the block, but not just the team, also the car company. For a cool $350-some million, you too could own your very own car manufacturer who makes track cars that nobody even knows what they are. And you could also have an F1 team, which would be a great place to put another $350 million before you even know what happened to it. Next up is Canada in 2 weeks, and I'll tell you, it's one of my favorite races. I love Canada, and let's keep the love going. I told you that Detroit was on ABC. Canada is on NBC. It's on the network too, baby. So tune in and watch this monster, wonderful GP. And that's the end of
Canada. Canada is a great track. Yeah, I agree.
And that's the end of Formula One coverage. So let's jump right into our 2.5 seconds of Flavored Corn Syrup 600 coverage. Gentlemen, did you watch it all?
Oh, no.
Did you watch any of
it? You know, if you read my blog, it's going to look like I did. But no, I didn't. I stayed awake for it all.
Well, that's good. Other things on television that were more entertaining or other things to do around the house?
Other things to do around the house. I had to pack. I had to put the kid to bed.
Yeah.
Folded laundry. Cleaned a drain.
You know, I think NASCAR. I think NASCAR kind of qualifies in that same area as Major League Baseball on television. I always thought of baseball as something you watched while you were doing many other things, like cooking dinner or doing homework or just had it on in the background while you're getting your hair cut or what have you. It's the background noise. And I think that's what NASCAR qualifies as, because when you have 5-hour races, you can't pay attention that long.
Well, not to mention that there's nothing that really happens in the race until the last, like, 15 laps.
This was the 600, which is the longest race on the NASCAR calendar. Watching an oval race on a 1.5-mile track live is a whole other ball game than watching it on TV. Because when you're live, when you're there in person, you get, you know, the smells, you get the, you get the breeze of the cars as they whiz by you every time, and
you feel it in your chest.
It's a whole other
The big V8s, you can feel that vibrating right through you. And and that actually relates, like you were saying, to baseball. You know, I'm sure going to a baseball game is a completely different experience from trying to watch it on TV.
Absolutely.
No, it's not. disagree. No, it's not.
You have not. You need to go to Wrigley then.
Maybe, I guess. Oh. but I have never been a fan of baseball ever, so
yeah,
I don't know. Man. I don't think I could be swayed that way. But having been to NASCAR oval races, we had season tickets at Texas. It's a lot of fun live because there's an energy there and a vibe. You don't feel that watching it on TV. You're watching Jimmy Johnson out in front and staying there.
Yeah. He is phenomenal. I mean, there's just no
argument.
And the thing is you can't knock him. He's not a bad guy. He's a great guy. He's the best damn NASCAR driver they've had.
Yeah.
Well, at the point, at the danger of making a point here, we've been talking about NASCAR for far too long. So let's just jump through it. Jimmy Johnson won, and Kurt Busch finished a few miles short of 1,100.
It was like 890 miles, I think, when his car blew up. That was like the total mileage count.
It's still a long day.
That's a very, not to mention the whatever the flight from Indy back to the.
If you are interested in it, they're going to do an IndyCar 36. I think that, or excuse me, whatever, Jimmy.
Jimmy 36?
Kurt Busch 36.
Kurt 36.
Over his whole time with IndyCar and NASCAR and practice and all that kind of stuff that led into this weekend. Should be a good show. If you're at all interested in Kurt Busch or just interested in the logistics of what it takes to be able to do this kind of thing, it'd be kind of neat to see. I think that airs mm-hmm. next weekend, but I may be wrong on that. So check your times and listings. That ends it for NASCAR. Let's jump into rally. Mike,
my take 2 seconds.
Away. Your 2 seconds. And
yeah, wow. For rally. I'll start off with today's supposed to be this weekend's supposed to be a really big weekend for rally in the United States, really. Start off with, we got the Susquehanna Trail Performance Rally, or STPR, as it's better known as, in Pennsylvania. That's this weekend. It's part of the Rally America Championship. Olympus, which I'm going to be attending this weekend, which is a regional event just now back on Rally America's schedule, where it was a NASA rally sport event before. So it's now, and next year is going to be part of the championship again. So I'll be up watching that one in person, seeing how the regional guys do. Hopefully, friend of the show, Dave Henderson, does much better than he did at OTR, where he slowly slid it off the road right in front of us. Also on the June 1st at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern, tune into NBC Sports Network, and you will get to watch all the action from the Oregon Trail Rally. They do have the coverage from Rally America's Oregon Trail will be on June 1st at 6 p.m. So set your DVR if you're not home to actually watch it. But it is on the NBC Sports Network, meaning that you're not going to be able to watch it, obviously, on the main channel, although you might be able to see it on the Live Extra as well after it airs. They sometimes do that stuff. As far as the other news going on, in the WRC, the FAA was meeting to lay the foundation for the next generation rally car. It was supposed to change in 2017, that they want to get a new setup out there. And the teams are going, 2016. They're like, we need to know now for development. You know, 2015 is right around the corner, and they need to know what to develop. And they're hopefully going to have something by this fall. They're just laying the basic groundwork of what those new generation cars are going to look like. I doubt we'll see a huge change. They're probably going to be similar chassis we have today. What would be interesting to see is if the word hybrid starts coming into play. Or whether it is that the R5s start taking over. One of the big talks is making what's called an R5 Plus. Basically, you take the R5, which is a much more affordable chassis, and you know, design than the full WRC spec cars, and just do a bigger or smaller restrictor. In other words, you know, bigger opening for the turbos, and so they go that much faster. Maybe different aero package, and that's it. We'll see what they come up with, but still a ways out. In other news, they had David Richards was commenting on what Joost Capito was talking about with the changes in the WRC about having that shootout for the final stage and, you know, the TV product and all that stuff and the failing numbers that the TV has had. And his thought is, you know what, forget TV, focus on the internet. Look at who your customer is. You know, you've got a lot of young people that are very tech savvy that are follow this sport. You guys need to get more coverage over the internet and not have TV as your primary focus. That's a hard thing to sell to sponsors. With TV, they can kind of fudge the numbers a little bit and say, hey, look, we're broadcasting out to this many million people. When you do internet coverage, you know how many people are actually playing that video.
Yeah, I mean, internet coverage is playing to your fan base. Television coverage is growing your fan base.
Yeah, that's fair to say. Although,
and then beyond
internet,
that,
the internet does still grow it because of its connection to social media, which has helped with growth quite a bit actually over the last couple of years. So I can't disagree with what David Richards said. I did also agree with some of the stuff that Joost Capito was coming up with his not that I 100% agree with the shootout thing, but I don't know. Maybe there's a happy medium between the two. I think they definitely need to have more internet coverage, though. For those places that they don't broadcast it as well as they do in some other countries, USA especially, it would be nice to have better coverage out there to reach out to your fans who then turn around and share it with their friends and whatnot, and it just builds up. So I think they do need to focus on that, but I think that should be in addition to, I don't think should be a primary focus per se. Speaking of Jost Capito, there's also a recent article that came out on Autosport where Jost was talking about how the great shootout or back and forth fight between Jari-Matti Latvala and Sebastian Ogier, and there was a little bit of speculation when Ogier on the final day decided to slow up just a little bit and thinking there was maybe some sort of team orders that were going to go in. And Ogier actually decided himself to slow it down, and he was going to save his tires to push on that final power stage, of which he ended up winning. And Jost said, you know what? I feel that team orders are a betrayal to our fans. If fans go to an event or they're watching an event and they go to it and they know this is, you know, when you're going into that final day, team orders are going to take effect and this is the results that are already going to happen. Why go? Why go? You already know what the finish is going to be. But I don't want to do it that way. It's a betrayal to the fans, and I am not going to do team orders at all this season. They can have at it. Now, that kind of doesn't necessarily matter considering the championship, the manufacturer's championship's already pretty much won. So you can say that now because the Volkswagens have won every single event. But yeah. It's nice to see that he's willing to let them battle it out and do a good show. It was a bit of a risk to do that, and it ended up being fabulous viewing slash listening on the internet radio to that coverage of how close it was trading stages down there in Argentina. So hats off to Jost to encourage that. Moving on, Rally America coverage. So STPR is the event coming up this weekend. It is one of the events on the Rally America National Championship calendar, and sadly, a lot of people are dropping out. It's a combination of different things. One would be damage to a car, not necessarily the car that is running the event. Other ones are schedule conflicts and things like that. First of all, it's Ken Block is not going to be there. His Global Rallycross Championship car, if you watched the coverage over this last weekend, he ended up rolling that car, and it got damaged so bad that the guys that work on his rally cars, the same team that would crew for him at STVR, they got to work on fixing a GRC car for X Games. And the rally car is a separate car, but he can't afford to have their time taken up supporting him at the rally. They need to fix the GRC car. So he had to back out. Antoine Lestage, he's still not going to be there. His funds are still not allowing him to do do American events as well as Canadian events. So he's still going to focus on the Canadian Championship Series only. Travis Pastrana, he's not there, which that's really kind of surprising. I thought Subaru was going to have Travis at every event except for that first event. I'm guessing a schedule conflict with Nitro Circus or something like that. I know they're turning around still. Super production champ David Sterix, he's racing in the Pirelli World Challenge up there in Detroit, so he's not going to make it. He'll be in that number 52 always evolving Mustang Boss 302, neat car. Sierra, the other SP previous champ out there, Lachlan O'Sullivan, he's not on the start list, so he's not going out to Pennsylvania. And here's the oddest one for me is the Matt Johnson and the Scion Rally XD, the ugly little bread box. They're not going to be going to STPR either. They didn't really say the reason was. I know they had an engine issue. The engine broke. I'm wondering if they're running into funding issues because all it said is we're unfortunately not going to make STPR this year, so we'll just have to look back at last year's race coverage and reminisce. Have a good and safe long weekend. That was kind of blasé, not really saying what the – sorry, you know, we had to do extra work on the car that just wasn't going to be done in time or something like that. It was really kind of odd, and I really liked seeing the competition with the Fords and wanted to see that continue, but missing out on an event, that's kind of sucky. And, of course, Romano Lagerman, who won at Oregon Trail, that was just kind of a one-off event that he did with Natalie Richard. They won the event in that beautiful-sounding BMW M3, but he's not going across over to Pennsylvania. On the plus side, we do still have David Higgins out there, you know, with the factory Subaru. And you'll have Adam Yeoman from FY Racing. So those guys will be the open class cars to watch. Nick Roberts and Rhianna Gelsomino. Rhianna's healed up amazingly well after her burns that she got from that car just cooking out in eastern Oregon. They were able to get a new car completely from scratch in 4 weeks, ready to go. That's pretty impressive for you know, stripping it down to its bare bones and from the ground up rebuilding a rally car. It's not like they have a huge crew or anything. So Nick Roberts and Rhianna will be out there. That'll be really good to watch the Super Production Championship. It'll be mostly between them and points leader Dylan Van Way. It's a pretty close championship in Super Production. You've got Van Wey now is at 51 points. David Sterik's down at 48, but since he's missing this event, it's going to knock him down. And Nick Roberts is at 37 points. So that you'll see some movement there, I would suspect, after this event. So it should make the rest of the season pretty exciting. When it comes to points for the open class, I mean, it's all David Higgins. Nobody else even really matters anymore. And in two-wheel drive, it's going to be ACP now in the now the Focus or Fiesta ST Turbo. So unless they have some sort of mechanical issues with the new turbo, but not really going to be as much of an event with all those different drivers gone, which is kind of too bad. Sorry about that. Other things to mention, I was wondering if anybody actually watched the GRC event on TV that was last weekend.
Unfortunately, I have not had the chance because I just absolutely have not had time since I got back from Indy. So.
Ah, yeah, that's understandable. Is it on your DVR then?
Yes, it is. I plan on watching it sometime this week, but I have not quite sure when that's going to be right now.
Yeah, yeah. I will say that, you know, it was pretty cool stuff. I was disappointed in some of the stuff that was skipped. Cramming all that into an hour-long program is, I think, very difficult. I think it should have been at least an hour and a half because they at times just showed like a small clip and they said, oh, and here's the results from this heat. They didn't show the full heat race. And I'm like, there was a little more that happened in that heat from what I remember. So, it was a little frustrating that they kind of spliced it, you know, up a bit. The significant moments were definitely shown, and it did show a good race. What I didn't realize before after watching that was how well Saveria Isaacson's Subaru was, how quick it really was in comparison to the other cars. I'd wrote a little review from basically what I'd followed on Twitter from what the event results were. But Saveri had a very, very fast car, but he was so darn sideways. I think what he did is he just overcooked the darn tires, and he just couldn't keep the damn thing straight. You'll enjoy, actually, the action of him trying to stay in third place. Just car just hanging out sideways, being basically a wall that nobody could get through, and then straighten it out and go down. It was pretty impressive. Anyway, last little notes that I was going to say is there was a World Rallycross Championship, which I don't normally talk about them much, but only because a couple of Americans are out there. It's the Lyddon Hill event, which is in Great Britain, and Mitchell DeJong that I interviewed with the over at the Red Bull Media Day. He's going to be the Indy Lights Red Bull-sponsored driver, and he's just damn quick. He was the only one that I thought was really competitive with Yoni Wyman, who went to the supercars this year, and he went and did the RX Lights at Lyddon Hill, and he just dominated over there. I think that's a sign of things to come with the GRC light, and that kicks off. Nelson Piquet Jr. also went over there and did a GRC light, or did a RX lights, as they call them over there. Same kind of car. He made it to the final. I'll give him credit for that. But then something happened. He ended up faltering and did a DNF in the final. In the supercars, Tanner Faust went over there to do a drive with the VW. And he unfortunately ended up in fifth, but he actually had another brain fart. Him and Petter Solberg both skipped doing the Joker. You have to do it once, and they both just skipped it, and ended up not really in the best starting position, so that didn't help him any. So, anyway, last thing I can say about Rally, the next WRC event up is Rally Italia Sardinia. That'll be not this coming weekend, but the following weekend, May 6th. And I'm looking forward to being out watching the cars. I'm going to be working start control this time for the first time out at Olympus Rally.
That'll be so.
It'll be some fun stuff.
Well, good deal. This once more, we had a marathon session of the Open Paddock Podcast covering everything that happens. Mike, John, I appreciate your time, and listen all the way through the show. I appreciate you as well. So thank you for joining us this week, and we will talk to you all later. Good night.
Good night.